Deep Sea Podcast Pressurized, a short, punchy version of our main feed that gets right to the scientific point. If you like what you hear and you'd like to hear the full episode, you can find it in the same feed. And now, to get right to the point. So, for this episode, we are going to focus on one particular critter. It was actually a listener request. Actually, Ken was one of the people who requested this. So people wanted a special episode on hagfish just because they are so weird and wacky. And I feel like people are aware of them, but they're maybe not as aware of just how unusual the hagfish are and what they sort of represent for, say, studying evolution and how fish have developed. We have had some firsthand interactions with hagfish, and they're always delightful. Never regret finding a hagfish.
Yeah, they're really hard to work with, but I find them fascinating. I wouldn't say I'm particularly fond of the hagfish. I'm kind of perhaps got a different type of respect for it, but yeah, they're funny old things.
They are. We are going to talk to Douglas Fudge, a professor of marine biology at Chapman University in California. His research aims to understand the biophysics and processes of marine animals, such as predator defense, feeding, and locomotion. His current projects aim to understand predator-prey interactions between hagfish and sharks, and the function of hagfish slime, and how the slime can be used in biomimic applications. Thanks so much for coming on and having a chat with us.
Oh, so great to be here, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
So we've touched on hagfish quite a lot in the past. They've turned up in a few of our other stories, but we haven't really had a chance to let them breathe and focus on them a bit more thoroughly. So let's start at the beginning. Could you explain what hagfish are and where we find them?
Yeah, so hagfish are a group of deep sea animals. You know, these are animals that are found on the bottom of the ocean in most of the oceans of the world. We don't tend to find them in the Arctic and the Antarctic, but pretty much everywhere else we find them. They're sort of eel-like in their morphology, but that's really the only resemblance to eel. So they're long and skinny like an eel, but they are not teleost fish like eels. They don't have fins, they don't have gills, they don't have jaws. So, you know, they look almost more like a worm than an eel when you get up close to it. In terms of their ecology, they are scavengers. So many of the listeners might have seen images or videos of hagfishes swarming around a dead whale. So when something dead falls to the bottom of the ocean, it's usually a hagfish that gets there first. So they're really good at the scavenging lifestyle. In terms of diversity, there's about 90 species that are described, and that number increases by one or two every year as we explore more of the deep sea.
And what are they doing when they're not scavenging? We obviously see them gather at our baited landers and at whale falls and things like that. Are they living in burrows? Are they hiding away somewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. So burrowing is something that we're very interested in, and it seems to be an important part of the hagfish lifestyle. We don't know how important it is. It seems that some species spend a lot of time in burrows and then other ones less so. But what is clear is that they have a very low energy lifestyle. So their strategy seems to be use as little energy as possible and wait until something delicious falls to the ocean floor and then be one of the first ones to get there. And then they have some other strategies for sort of defending food that they find as well. And we can talk about that when we talk more about slime.
There may be some listeners who are struggling to visualize a hagfish. So it's about a foot long to a couple of feet long, maybe long, slender eel-like thing. There's a single nostril usually at the very snout end. And some, what's the technical term for those whiskers almost?
Barbels is the technical term for those. Yeah. And there's six of those sort of sticking out from the face. And as you said, there's a giant single nostril on the front of the face. And that's the sort of water intake for their gills. They have multiple gill pouches, and those are sort of further back on the body. And then there's these little holes called gill apertures where the water exits the body after irrigating the gills.
And there's one mysterious one, isn't there? It has a separate name. There's one of those outlets is larger than the others. Do we know why yet?
Yes. So this is interesting. So there's a little tube called the pharyngocutaneous duct, and that connects the pharynx with the last gill aperture. Okay, so, you know, let's say we're talking about a given species of hagfish that has six gill pouches. That hagfish might have six gill apertures on each side, but on the left side, the last gill aperture might be a little bit bigger because that extra duct fuses with that last gill aperture. And so the gill apertures look a little bit asymmetrical on the left side and the right side. Now, where it gets a little complicated is one of the genera, Myxini, which is the second largest genus of hagfishes, has multiple gill pouches, but only a single gill aperture on each side. And we don't really understand why that is. For some reason, they've sort of gotten rid of individual gill apertures, and they have a single aperture close to that final, most posterior gill. And in those species, the left side opening is much bigger than on the right side because of that pharyngeocutaneous duct that fuses with it.
And do we know what the duct is for? Is it for clearing larger material from the gills? Or
I don't fully understand what it's for. Somebody might, but I have thought about it and I don't fully understand it, because they do seem to be able to reverse flow and sort of cough out their nostril, and they'll do this if they get slime in their face. So I don't fully understand what that duct is there for.
Yeah, there's something going on. It seems so deliberate, but yeah, maybe we've not fully gotten to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
You can sort of see a shadow of eyes, that there's light receptive patches where we'd usually associate eyes.
Yeah, again, this depends on the species, but the Pacific hagfish that we have in our tanks in my lab, they look like they have an eye spot, and it's, you know, it's almost like an orca, like it's too big to be an eye. And then what you realize is that it's a transparent window in the skin, and the actual eye is in the middle of that transparent window below it. So very strange kind of situation, with an eye totally covered with skin. Maybe not that surprising for an animal that burrows a lot.
Yeah, and pushes into flesh as well.
Yeah, but then the Atlantic hagfish, they don't have a transparent window. They still have this sort of, you know, vestigial eye. If you dissect the skin away from the head, there it is. But there's no transparent window. There's just like, there's skin, there's layers of muscle. There's just no way there's light coming through in a way that would allow them to form any kind of image in those species.
Is the same true of the juveniles? We see that in some of the cusk eels. They use their eyes less and less as they get bigger. And they kind of skin over.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure about that. I've never noticed in the really little ones that they have a transparent window. That's a really good thing to look for. But I'm pretty sure it's the same in the little ones.
Yeah.
There is one species that we just described it a few years ago. This is a new species from the Galapagos, and it's a completely albino hagfish. And so we gave it the name the ghost hagfish because it just looks very strange, and it's white, has zero pigment in its skin. And in the young ones, they're basically transparent. The skin is completely transparent. You can see the slime glands, you can see the heart beating, you can see the blood going through the gills. So that's a kind of interesting thing. It's not a transparent window, it's just the entire skin is transparent.
Yeah. And the ancestral state seems to have eyes. There was some fossils found recently where it looks like they used to have more well-developed eyes, and then this is actually a more modern state.
Yeah, I think that's becoming clear, is that they probably had pretty decent eyes if you go back far enough. And it was probably this adoption of a burrowing lifestyle that led them to start losing the eyes. But I should say that they are light sensitive. So, you know, even the ones that have this thick skin over the eyes, and they're clearly light sensitive. So when we open our tanks, you know, they respond to the light. So what's going on there? Like, do they have photoreceptors in the skin? That's my guess, but not much is known about that.
Cool. And I suppose the elephant in the room, the one of the things they're famous for, if we're talking sort of gross anatomy, is being Nathan, basically, about not having a jaw, not having a true jaw. So they have a very interesting apparatus at the business end. Could you tell us a little bit about sort of how they feed and that jawless structure?
Yeah. So, you know, the jawless name is a little bit misleading because it implies that they are really kind of simple up front and you know that they were just sort of like a worm with a hole on the front or something like that. The truth is very different from that. They have an incredibly complex anatomy at the anterior end associated with feeding. And, you know, they don't have jaws in the sort of technical sense and evolutionary sense of what we think of as structures that move up and down dorsoventrally and that were derived most likely from gill arches. But they have structures that essentially function as jaws. They sort of move left to right horizontally, so not up and down like you normally think of the jaws. And a podcast is probably the worst venue for trying to describe their anatomy. So there's a couple of colleagues of mine who have done some really nice work on the anatomy of the feeding apparatus in hagfishes. So Ted Uyeno and Andrew Clark have been working on this, and it's really complicated and really fascinating. They have these horny teeth that are not true teeth. They're not bony. They're sort of keratinous in terms of the material they're made of. And they can use muscles to avert them. You've probably seen sort of scary images of hagfish on the internet with the teeth averted. And then they have this really powerful retractor muscle that can pull those teeth back in. And, you know, if it's something like a squid tentacle, it will sort of slurp it in. But they're sharp enough and powerful enough that if it's soft flesh, they can actually tear off a chunk. Mm.
And burrow into flesh as well, don't they? They tear and really get in there.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one of the sort of amazing things that hagfishes do is they will burrow into a carcass and hang out there and sort of eat their way out, which, you know, physiologically for most animals, that would not be possible because there's no oxygen inside a rotting carcass. So that's another really cool thing about hagfishes is their ability to go without oxygen.
And are they coping without oxygen? One of my little factoids, which I want to double check is actually accurate. Can they ventilate through the anus? Is that a thing like sea turtles?
Oh, I've never heard that. Have you read that in the paper?
Oh, I got that somewhere. I need to check. I need to check because I got quoted on that at one point. So I need to find out where I got that from.
I mean, it's not impossible. Now that I think of it, so I mentioned burrowing before. We've been doing some experiments on burrowing in the lab. We finally managed to get hagfish to burrow in captivity, and we've managed to get them to do it in clear substrates. So we have a paper in review right now on hagfish burrowing in gelatin.
Oh, wow. Oh, that must look amazing.
It's amazing. And, you know, and for a long time, you know, we've known about hagfish burrowing. You know, you guys go down with your cameras and occasionally you see a hagfish driving its head into the mud. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is, you know, they make these U-shaped burrows and sometimes their tail is poking out a little bit. So I wonder if it's possible that they're doing gas exchange across their tail when they're in a burrow.
Bit of a bum snorkel.
Exactly. And one other thing I should mention about hagfish that is yet another weird thing is they have what's known as a subcutaneous sinus that is quite large. So basically their skin is not very well attached to the rest of their body. And there's all this space in between. And there's quite a bit of blood there. So it's estimated about 30% of their blood volume is in that subcutaneous sinus. And some have suggested that blood is involved in cutaneous respiration.
Wow. Okay. And would also be a repository of oxygen as well, I'm guessing, a bit like myoglobin.
Yeah, possibly.
There's so many unusual quirks to them. I'm so glad they're still around.
I know. I mean, they've been around for a long time. If you think about the extinction events that they have survived, it's really quite remarkable.
Yes, that was one of the questions actually, is how have they survived these events? And are they a bit like the chimera? Are they almost a prototype that used to be abundant in the shallows that have been preserved in the deep sea?
I don't know. You know, we have two hagfish fossils, so there's not a lot to go on.
It's a lot of extrapolation for a whole group.
Yeah, but you know, I can see that. I don't see any reason why they couldn't have started out in shallower water and then moved into deeper water. One of the ways that I understand their current distribution, which tends to be on the deep-ish side, so usually 100 meters and deeper, down to about 3,000 meters. And we'll talk about the slime later, I'm sure, but the slime is really effective at protecting them from fish predators, but it has zero effect on air breathing predators.
Yeah.
So, you know, whales and seabirds that can dive that deep, pinnipeds, they just slurp up hagfish very happily and they don't mind the slime. So I think that really explains a lot about where we find hagfish, because they're essentially immune to being eaten by fish, but they're very vulnerable to marine mammals and birds. And so I think, you know, that drives them down and keeps their abundance pretty low in the upper depths.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I'll stop burying the lead then. Let's talk about what they're most famous for, which give them some of their common names: slime eels, snot eels. So the slime is a big factor on these guys, and they seem to use it for a multitude of different purposes. At least I've sort of observed them using it a little bit differently. Will we go in with the sort of mechanics of the slime, because even that is incredibly complex. The little packets of threads and the mucus that goes with it. So what is the sort of structure of hagfish slime and what makes it so unique?
Yeah, so it's probably best to start with the anatomy of the glands that make it. So a typical hagfish has, let's say, 180 slime glands. Okay, so 90 slime glands on each side of its body. They tend to occur just in a line down the body. And there's really no place on a hagfish where a predator can bite without, you know, there being a nearby slime gland that is going to shoot out slime in response. So these are small-ish structures. They're, you know, a couple of millimeters in diameter. The glands are surrounded by muscle. And when that muscle contracts, it basically squeezes the contents of the gland very forcefully out into the surrounding seawater, maybe even into the predator's mouth who's biting them. And something happens when that material, we call it exudate, mixes with seawater. It expands about 10,000 times to form this remarkable material that is really good at clogging gills of fishes. So let's unpack that a little bit. So there's two components that are made within the glands. One of them is a fibrous component, and these are silk-like fibers. They're about 15 centimeters long when you sort of lay them out end to end. They're about 1 micron in diameter. So, you know, a little thinner than your typical spider silk. And it turns out their material properties are pretty similar to spider silk in many ways. In a typical volume of slime given off by a hagfish, which is about a liter, there's about 25,000 of these spider silk fibers. Now, the other component is a mucus component, and that's what gives the slime its sort of slimy texture. And there's another kind of cell that produces the mucus component, and those cells rupture when the slime gland contracts, and there's billions and billions of these little packets of mucus. Those swell up and do something really interesting that we don't fully understand. They interact with the threads, they interact with the seawater, and the net result is this material that, as I said, is really good at clogging the gills of predators.
Wow. And from observation, it seems to be almost reflexive. So if you touch a hagfish or pinch it at one point, only those glands seem to fire?
Yes. So for a long time, we didn't realize that. So when you catch hagfish on a boat, and maybe you've experienced this, Tom, you know, the slime is coming out everywhere.
Yeah, the whole thing's angry.
You can just see this milky stuff pouring out of the slime glands. And it wasn't until we filmed hagfish in captivity under semi-realistic conditions and sort of pretended like we were biting them that we realized that, you know, it's only in the vicinity of where they're getting bitten that they release the slime. So that's interesting. And it also, you know, it obviously makes sense. The slime is probably a pretty big energy investment for the hagfish. So it doesn't make sense for the whole animal to be shooting slime out in every direction.
And it's so effective. I didn't know that about the mucus component, that there isn't sort of a bladder or a reservoir of it. The cells themselves are sacrificed. Mm-hmm. They can produce a lot and it's spectacular, but it's got to take quite a long time to recover, isn't it? The cells have got to be regrown rather than just producing more mucus.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a PhD student who looked into this question of slime gland regeneration. So this was Sarah Shorno's work work at the University of Guelph. And the answer she came up with is that it basically takes a month for them to refill a slime gland that has been emptied. So again, another reason not to shoot them all off at once, because, you know, a hagfish without slime would be very vulnerable.
And I've seen it. It seems incredibly effective as a defense, like you say, especially for anything with gills. Do we think if a shark gets a good dose, is that shark probably going to die? It's incredibly difficult to get the slime off. From personal experience, I wouldn't want to be breathing it.
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that. And I haven't done the experiment. I'm not looking forward to the animal care protocol that would have to be written to do that experiment. But, you know, you've probably seen the videos from the group at Te Papa, actually, Vincent and colleagues.
Yes, yeah. The little dogfish having a chomp.
You know, these sharks coming in, biting hard on a hagfish, and then just swimming away with a mouthful of slime kind of streaming out of its gills. And yeah, the obvious question is, what happens to that shark? We don't know, because, you know, in all these videos, the predator swims away and we don't see it anymore. But I can tell you a little bit about what we know from our lab experiments working with the slime. So in those experiments, we were really interested in understanding how the mucus was contributing and how the threads, those really fine fibers, were contributing. And I had always assumed that the fibers were really important for the clogging function. And so we did an experiment where we physically separated the mucus and the threads and measured the clogging performance separately. And the amazing thing we found was that the mucus alone is pretty much as good as the whole slime with the fibers in it.
Wow.
So it's really the mucus that's doing the clogging. So that led to another interesting question, which is, you know, what the heck are the fibers even doing there? They're clearly really complicated to make. The cells that make them are just one of the most interesting cells you can imagine. They spin this ball of yarn in their cytoplasm that is just an incredible structure. Clearly, selection is, you know, invented these things and perfected them over millions of years for a reason.
Yeah.
And so our current understanding is that the fibers are there to keep the slime on the gills. So we did another experiment where we tried to wash the slime away. And this relates to your question of, you know, what happens to the shark? Is the slime there forever, or can they flush it away? So we tried sort of chasing the slime with just seawater. And we just kept doing that and measuring the drain rate. And what we found is that if you leave out the fibers, you know, the first go of the mucus alone is really good at slowing the flow. But if you flush it again, you pretty much reduce the clogging effect to almost nothing. So in other words, it's really easy to sort of wash it away. If you have the fibers in there, on the other hand, it's really hard to wash the fibers or wash the mucus away. So you can flush it with about 20 volumes more of seawater and the performance stays pretty similar. So again, your question of how long does the slime remain on there? Does the shark suffocate? Can it get it off? We don't know exactly, but
it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. But I'll say one more complication, which is that we were adding water from the top of our clogging assay, whereas a shark has the ability to back flush. Mm-hmm. So we weren't back flushing. So, you know, maybe a shark, if it really forcefully back flushes, might be able to recover enough gill function to squeeze through.
Which seems to be the first response. Like that classic video that the team took here, it immediately coughs and coughs out this big bolus of slime.
Yeah.
Are they vulnerable at all themselves to this defense? If I've seen too many in too small a container, I think I've seen them sort of choke themselves.
Yeah, so I get this question a lot because people know that hagfish have gills and the slime is really good at clogging gills. So what's going on there? So the reason the slime works so well against jawed fishes is because of the way the mouth is set up in relation to the gills. Let's say you're getting swallowed by a shark, right? As you're going down into the mouth, you're going past the gills. They're right there, right? And for the hagfish, that's sort of their opportunity, right? So they, in the process of being eaten, they slime the gills, and that's their strategy. Hagfish gills are not in the mouth. And so they're not vulnerable in that way. They're sort of, as we said before, they've got this nostril on the front of their head. It bleeds via these pipes down to their gill pouches, which are sort of neatly tucked away. And so it'd be really difficult for their slime to sort of slime their own gills. And your second question about, you know, can they suffocate themselves? I think that's true. If you have hagfish in a bucket and they're stressed out and they turn all of the water in the bucket to slime, which they're very capable of doing if there's enough of them, yeah, eventually they will suffocate because they can't breathe slime. And another amazing thing that hagfishes do that many of your listeners will know about is knot tying. And they do this for various reasons, but one of the reasons is if they do happen to get caught in their own slime, which is pretty rare under kind of natural conditions, but certainly in a bucket, if they have nowhere to go, they might end up inside a big mass of slime. But if that happens, what they do is they tie their body in a knot and then they pass their body through that knot. And that has the effect of essentially wiping the slime off of their body.
And they can use that knot as an anchor as well, don't they? They do it for a few different reasons, but that almost gives them leverage. They can push off from a burrow or from a carcass using that.
Yeah, exactly. You might have seen videos of hagfish feeding maybe on a whale carcass, and they'll tie their body in a knot. They'll sort of brace their head up against the carcass with a sort of loop of that overhand knot, and then, you know, use that to more forcefully tear chunks away from the carcass.
They are amazing.
Yeah, it's clever.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I knew this was an area I only knew the tip of an iceberg, and it just got weirder and weirder. And I don't think I've seen the bottom. It's just carrying on below me.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. There's still so much to do.
That's right. Okay. Well, this was super fun.
After speaking with Doug, we got an update actually, because we were talking about the pharyngeocutaneous duct. So they have these gill pouches, they have these little holes where the water leaves the body, but then on one side, usually one of them is a little bit bigger and it seems to be connected directly to the pharynx, directly to the throat without going via the gills. And Doug just updated us that a lot of the old hagfish books used to say that this was a way of ejecting particles that were too big for the gills, so that would have clogged the gills. And that was sort of the general consensus. But he personally thinks that doesn't make much sense because that is actually behind all the gills. So if it was going to clog them, it would have already clogged them. And fish can kind of cough and reverse the flow to sort of dislodge things. But he reckons it's probably more to do with squeezing the food to remove any excess water before they swallow it and digest it. Because if you swallow lots of water, you dilute your stomach acid and enzymes and digestion isn't so effective. And because of the way they sort of feed and rasp and tear at flesh, it actually makes sense for them to wring it out like a sponge before they swallow it, so they're not taking on loads of water. So yeah, nice little update. Thanks for writing back in, Doug, and closing that loop. Because yeah, there's weird anatomy on these things, as you will have heard. And that was a pressurized version of one of our longer episodes. If you enjoyed that and you would like to hear the full length episode, just match the episode numbers and you'll be able to find the full length version in the feed. Thanks for listening. We'll deep see you next time, and I hope to see you all. If you would like to advertise with the Deep Sea Podcast, feel free to get in touch. Our audience is primarily young people with an interest in science, often undergraduates or people considering a degree in marine science, but it also includes established scientists. Feel free to get in touch if you're interested in reaching these groups.